In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about single-sex education. Now, while it is certainly the norm, continues to be the norm in this country, that boys and girls go to school together, within the last few years, the idea of single-sex schools has gained in popularity, and the numbers have increased. Now, this continues to be somewhat controversial. There are people who wonder whether it's a good idea in terms of socialization for boys and girls. There are also people who raise legal questions, at least when it comes to public schools, whether in fact it's legal to have single-sex schools. However, there are other people who continue to argue that for boys and girls, there are benefits to going to schools that are all boys schools and all girls schools. We'll talk about the issue this morning and talk a little bit about some of the research that's been done and what it says. And our guest for the program is Rosemary Solomon. She is the Kenneth Wong Professor of Law at St. John's University School of Law, and that's in New York. She's also a fellow of the Open Society Institute, former faculty member of the Graduate School of Education at Harvard University. And she has authored a book which is entitled Same, Different, Equal, Rethinking Single-Sex Education, and it's published by the Yale University Press. She's joining us this morning by telephone. As always, we encourage people who are listening to call in if you have questions or comments. The only thing we ask is that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many people as possible. But if you'd like to call, you can certainly do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions or comments, you are certainly welcome to call. Professor Solomon, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I guess now that you are one of the country's experts on the subject of single-sex schooling, although I don't think that you necessarily set out to do that, to make that a special focus, how is it that you became so involved in studying this issue?
No, this certainly was not a topic that was even on my radar screen in terms of research. I was finishing another book on a totally different topic when I became engaged, I guess you would say, in the Young Women's Leadership School, which opened in New York City in the summer of 1996. And at that time, the sponsor of that school, it's a public school, but it was a private sponsor who was promoting the school and helping to design it, called me because when it hit the newspapers, the local newspapers in New York City, that the New York City Board of Education was planning an all-girls school in East Harlem, which is a very poor, disadvantaged community in New York. The New York Civil Liberties Union and the New York chapter for NOW, the National Organization for Women, were threatening to sue. And so I received a call from out of the blue asking me, well, is this legal? You know, this individual knowing that I had done some work on Title IX and on gender issues. And so I looked into it, and to me it seemed that it was really open to interpretation of the law, that there were some strong legal arguments supporting these schools. And so as that summer wore on and the debate was swirling around the political circles and media circles in New York City, I became drawn into that debate, and the school did open the end of that summer in late August, but I also became a passionate defender of the school because it seemed so clear to me that this was a golden opportunity for poor girls, to provide equal educational opportunity for poor girls. I myself had attended an all-girls high school, but had never thought much about the single-sex aspect of it. You know, I had left that behind and always felt very indebted to the school for the academic rigor of the program itself and what it had provided me. But in looking at this school and starting to look into some of the research on single-sex schooling, I realized that my own experience, much of that, and what ultimately became of my life had to do with having attended a single-sex school as an adolescent. And so as I started writing small pieces and was called upon more to write small pieces on the topic and advise more schools looking to initiate these programs, people kept saying to me, well, there really is a book here. And so there's the book. Ultimately, it did come to fruition.
Mm. You do spend a significant amount of time in the book looking at how it is over time we have thought about the issue of same-sex education and co-education. That's something probably we could talk about for a long time. But what I think is interesting is the way that we seem to have gone back and forth between thinking that one or the other was better. Can you do a thumbnail sketch of how it is we've thought about that?
Well, you know, initially, we have a very strong tradition in this country of co-education, which is very different, say, from Great Britain, which has a much stronger, or Australia or New Zealand, other English-speaking schools, where single-sex schools were much more favored. Within public schooling, the U.S. has a very strong tradition of co-education. Within private schooling, there's more of a tradition here of single-sex schooling, but that has changed in recent decades. Initially, co-educational schools were cost-efficient, particularly in rural areas. It was just cheaper. It was less expensive to, we had small populations and not a very dense population, to educate boys and girls in one setting. And so we moved into co-education not based on any grand philosophy, educational philosophy. It was really a matter of practicalities. And so it stood. In the early 1900s, we did have various forms of single-sex schooling, particularly in large cities, especially in the East, like Boston and New York and Baltimore and Philadelphia. Many of those programs were vocational education programs, and they were designed for immigrant children. And the theory was that many of these children were just not fit for academic pursuit, and so we had to teach them some kind of a trade. And those schools and classes were very gender separate and very gender stratified. Boys were prepared for jobs that were more lucrative, where they could earn an income, drafting, for example, or auto mechanics, aviation. In New York City, we had an aviation high school until recent decades that was only for boys. Girls were prepared for to be seamstresses, to be secretaries, to be hairdressers. And these were traditionally women's jobs where the pay was much lower. When it came to the 1960s and the women's movement, and then 1972 when Congress enacted Title IX of the Education Amendments that year, many of these programs went by the boards because they were deemed to be illegal, particularly in violation of Title IX. And it was also a matter of appealing to market forces. With the women's movement, single-sex schools were considered gender stereotyping, that there was a push within the women's movement, and rightly so, for assimilation, that women, the idea was that women were equal to men on all the relevant characteristics, and therefore women should have the same education as men had. And there was a real movement toward access and opening of institutions of higher ed, like Harvard and Princeton and Yale, for example, and the University of Virginia, as well as prestigious public high schools in some of the major cities, like Boston Latin, like Central High School in Philadelphia, like the Bronx High School of Science in New York City. And so we saw single-sex education just recede into the background. But then in the late 1980s, there was a growing concern about the plight of the underclass in inner-city schools. Poor, disadvantaged minority students, African-American students and Latino students, and where conventional education was just failing them and failing them miserably. And there was this thought, particularly, it really started in Milwaukee and Detroit. There was this thought of providing single-sex schooling for boys in particular, for African-American boys. And that's what started inner-city school reformers thinking again about separate schooling for boys and girls, that perhaps there's something to be said for separating students by sex, you know, to eliminate the social distractions, to focus on more clearly on academics. And that's when we see around 1990 or so, and then moving into the 1990s, a growing interest in single-sex schooling, particularly for at-risk students. But even during that time, we had a number of studies coming from the American Association of University Women, for example, looking at how schools were failing girls. And so you saw an increase in interest, and it wasn't intention by AUW, but there was it generated increased interest among private schools and private school parents for single-sex schooling. So through the 1990s and into the new millennium, we see an increase in applications to private single-sex schools, particularly girls' schools, and an increase in enrollment. So, you know, we have these dual forces operating, the problems of at-risk students in the inner city, and then what was perceived to be the failure of schools to address the needs of girls. And that's what really pushed the movement among private schools.
I should introduce again the guest with this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Rosemary Salomon. She's professor of law, the Kenneth Wong Professor of Law at St. John's University School of Law. That's in New York. And she is one of the country's leading authorities on single-sex education. She has written about it in the book that I mentioned at the beginning of the program. It's titled Same, Different, Equal, Rethinking Single-Sex Schooling, and it's published by the Yale University Press. So the book is out there if you're interested. And questions, comments are also welcome, too, here on the program, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Within the past 5 or 6 years, I guess, there has been a significant increase in the number of children attending same-sex schools, although the total numbers, it's still a small percentage of all of the schools. But when you look at the rate of increase, it's certainly significant. How many single-sex schools are there now in the United States?
I'm not certain. There may be about 16 or 17, but I'm really not certain. And it's a little bit difficult identifying them because you have some schools that are totally single-sex, such as the Young Women's Leadership School in New York City. You have some that are what we call dual academies, where you have separate classes for boys and girls within the same building, within the same facility. In New York, we have the Brighter Choice Charter Academies in Albany or follow that model. You have a number of schools around the country that are initiating single-sex classes within a coeducational setting, but the entire school is not single-sex. So there might be certain grades, or they might provide options for students to in certain subjects, math or science or English or foreign languages, but the entire school is not single-sex. So it's really hard to set on a fixed number of how many of these programs, because there are so many permutations on the theme of, and you know, how do you identify what in fact is a single-sex school?
And here, I just want to make sure we're clear that you're talking about public schools.
That's right.
Right.
That's
and right. Because there certainly are single-sex private schools and
certainly
probably a fair number of
certainly.
Them. Is when you look at the single-sex schools are and you look at how many of them are girl schools and how many of them are boy schools, does it tend to lean one way or another, or are the numbers fairly even in terms of gender?
In the private sector, I believe there are more girl schools than boy schools. You know, in the private sector, many of the schools that historically were co-ed were transformed in the 1960s and the 1970s. Either they opened their doors to the other sex or they merged. It was a boy school and a girl school merging together. Within public schools, maybe there are a few more schools for girls. I'm not sure, because there really is a significant amount of talk of opening more schools for boys in the inner city. And there are a number, again, of these dual academies where you have separate classes for boys and girls within the same facility. So I don't think there's a dramatic difference between the two sexes in terms of the number of students being served or the number of schools. I know the general talk in New York City, for example, now we do have one girls' school, and I understand there's another girls' school opening in another part of the city that's being planned, but there's also a boys' school that's planned to open next September as well.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit earlier about the how over time people have thought about this subject and the fact that I think at first it was that people, primarily women, women academics, maybe some feminists, were taking a look at what was happening with girls in school, and were talking about the fact that public schools were not serving the interests of girls. And then a little bit later, some people raised parallel, different but parallel arguments, saying, well, you know, they're not doing such a great job for the boys. When you look at what it is that girls and boys get out of participating in single-sex schools, I expect they are probably different. Some of the same things, but some things are different. So let's talk a little bit about each group. If I ask the question, what do you think that girls get out of going to girls' schools? How would you answer that?
For girls, and when I talk to the girls, I spent a considerable amount of time, certainly at the Young Women's Leadership School in New York, which is a middle school that goes into a high school, and at Philadelphia High School for Girls and Baltimore's Western High School. And those are the three schools that I feature in the book. So I have spent time talking to girls. And what they tell me is that the school provides them with a safe haven, particularly in the inner city. It frees them not only from the social distraction of boys, it frees them from the pressure of engaging in early sexuality. It frees them from sexual harassment that they've experienced in their prior schools. They say that they have more of an opportunity to participate verbally in class, that the boys are not dominating. They're not there to dominate the discussion. You know, our popular culture and our hip-hop culture that our teenagers are so much a part of really has a very heavy sexual element. And single-sex programs, again, can provide that safety, that safe haven from those social pressures, and the opportunity to channel their energies into academic pursuits. The girls also tell me that they feel a sense of camaraderie. They keep using the metaphor of family, and that came up again and again in not only those three schools, but other schools that I visited around the country, other girls' schools. Girls always talk about being a family, that they sense that there's more of a sense of collegiality amongst them. Now, whether that's true or not, you know, there's lots of literature now about preteen girls and teenage girls and the cliquishness and the social pressures that exist among girls themselves. So I'm not trying to gloss over that or to negate it. But these seem to be the value, the merit that girls see in single-sex schooling.
Well, what if we turn that around and I ask the same question and say, now, what is it that boys get out of going to school with boys?
What I saw in boys' schools really did surprise me in a very positive way. Boys' schools were totally alien to me. I had never been in a boys' school. I myself had been a student in a girls' school, so I understood the culture much better. And I always had a certain skepticism toward boys' schools. You know, coming out of the feminist movement in the 70s myself, I saw boys' schools as bastions of male privilege. Well, when I looked at these schools and I visited some of the most prestigious boys' schools, particularly in New York City, where we have a number of them, which are really very fine schools, I wanted to see what we offer our most advantaged students and use that as a determinant of what we might offer our least advantaged boys. And what I saw really opened my eyes to a much more positive experience than I had anticipated. I saw less gender polarization in the curriculum. And what I mean by that is, very typically, you see girls veering towards the humanities in high school, toward English and toward foreign languages, and less so toward science and math. And in boys' schools, you would typically see fewer boys involved in foreign languages or fewer boys involved in a co-ed school. In the boys' schools, there were more boys involved in the drama club because everybody, you know, the only people they had there to participate in the drama club were, in fact, boys. More boys participating in choir, more boys interested in what would stereotypically be thought of as the girl subjects, like foreign languages and like English literature. I visited one all-boys school where I saw a whole room of middle school boys playing the violin. Well, I really don't think you would see that. I would be shocked to see that in a co-ed school or a school where they perform an opera each year. Well, in a boys' setting, well, you just would be hard pressed again to see that boys engaged in that kind of an activity in a co-ed school. So there seemed to be less gender polarization in the curriculum and in course choices. I also saw boys playing a very nurturing role, older boys toward younger boys in the school, sitting in the hallway on the floor reading to a first grader, you know, seeing a middle school do that with a first grade boy. You don't see that very much in co-ed schools. So what I saw in the boys' schools was a much softer side than I would have anticipated having gone in them. The boys' schools seem to have changed, and the schools I visited were in the private sector because they're hard to find in the public sector now, totally all boys' schools. A lot of them are just in the planning stages. What I saw were more women on these faculty than you would have seen 20 years ago. There were women administrators. You wouldn't have seen that 20 years ago. So I think we have to rethink what boys' schools are and what boys' schools potentially could be.
You just there touched on one of the questions that I wanted to ask. When you look at gender breakdown of faculty, do there tend to be more women teachers in the girls' schools and more men teachers in the boys' schools?
Yes, no doubt. And part of that is a positive because it does provide, and this is especially so for inner-city minority boys, inner-city African, poor African-American boys who really do need positive male role models in their lives. And so the fact that a large number of faculty are male is a positive for those boys. But then again, you do need some women on the faculty, and these boys have to see men and women interacting in a professional sense on an equal level. That's very important for them to, you know, foresee themselves as adults and how they would relate to women.
That gets another issue. Some people, I think, would make the argument that you talked about the fact that, for example, some people who argue for single-sex schools say one of the benefits is it does eliminate the social distractions of the boys and girls being together, having to impress one another, and perhaps sometimes conforming to the worst of the gender roles of each side. The other side of that argument, I guess, would be that it's important for boys and girls to learn to live with one another so that when they grow up to be men and women, they will know how to relate, particularly on an equitable basis. How do you confront that argument that says that boys and girls are going to miss out on some important socialization if they go to same-sex schools?
There's no doubt that there is a trade-off. That's undeniable. And what you're trading off is some piece of that socialization. But single-sex schools, and that's the issue here of how they're designed, how they're planned, and how they're implemented. And the whole idea is a work in progress now because we have to look at these schools in the context of what we've learned over the past 20, 30 years about child development and child socialization. And so I believe very strongly that single-sex schooling should not isolate students by gender. And that there should be brother and sister schools where they can come together not just for social activities, but also for some academically oriented activities as well, where they, you know, a large part of their day would be separate, but then there would be some programs that could be jointly sponsored by a boys' school and a girls' school. And educators have to be very mindful of that and not forget that aspect of socialization. Again, it should not only be dances and social events that would be planned to get the two groups together, but there should be some intellectual pursuits that they should engage in together as well.
We are at our midpoint here, and again, I should introduce our guest. We're talking with Professor Rosemary Solomon. She's Kenneth Wong Professor of Law at St. John's University School of Law in New York City, and has done a lot of thinking about and writing about researching on the subject of single-sex education. She's authored a book on the subject. If you'd like to look at it, it's titled Same, Different, Equal, Rethinking Single-Sex Schooling, and it's published by the Yale University Press. Questions are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Do you think that, or is there evidence to show that disadvantaged children, children who come from difficult backgrounds, where there's a lot of poverty, and other things that work against them that put them at risk. Is there any evidence to show that that kind of child benefits more from attending a single-sex school than a child from a more middle-class background?
There was a study conducted in the 1980s on Catholic schools. And that study found that there is a hierarchy of status characteristics by which students would benefit most from single-sex schooling. And the highest ones to benefit the most would be by gender and social disadvantage. So it would be poor minority girls. And then next it would be poor minority boys and then middle-class girls. And the study found that there might not be much of a difference for middle-class and more privileged boys. So there is that data, the research that we have from the 1980s, that really, and it was conducted on Catholic schools, it really does beg for replication. But I think there's something intuitive about that, too, because when you look at just particularly at the high school level, and again, that notion of social distraction. For teenagers, single-sex programs really place the intellectual above the social, and that's particularly important in communities where students don't necessarily identify with academic achievement. In a more privileged community, some of what James Coleman back in 1960 called the cruel jungle of rating and dating in high schools, some of that is tempered to a significant degree by the high value that parents and the community place on academic achievement and college placement in a more privileged community. But for disadvantaged minority boys, for example, many of them, too many of them, gain their self-esteem from sports or from social popularity. And for disadvantaged minority girls, too many of them really look for validation in early motherhood. And so many of them are pregnant at least once, sometimes twice, by the time they leave their teen years. There is an argument to be made, aside from the research, the hard data that we have, that these programs just provide the kind of context that is really most needed by at-risk students.
Hmm. It seems like for quite a long time now, for a number of years, we've been talking about how it is we might change schools, public schools in particular, to make them better serve the needs of students. And then when you get to this question of looking at particular kinds of reforms or particular kinds of structures and you ask, well, which ones work better, it gets to be very difficult to answer that question because to answer it, you need to get bodies of students who are comparable and that then put them in different structures and find out whether the structure makes any difference. And to get to do that study is really tough, to get groups of students that are truly, you can truly say they are the same except for the schools, that the way that their schools they attend are structured. So having said all that, is it possible that can you make good sorts of conclusions about the effect of attending a single-sex school on student performance as measured by these standard ways that we have of measuring it?
It's very difficult because this is not pure science. You know, we're not conducting these quote-unquote experiments in a lab. And so, and in particular, for this particular approach, the single-sex schooling really should be voluntary, that this should be purely a matter of students and their parents choosing to enter into a single-sex program. This should not be the only option offered to them by a school district, for sure. And so part of it is that, if they're choosing to attend a single-sex program, there might be a select group of students who are going into these programs. So they might be more highly motivated students or more academically motivated students or more involved parents who make that decision. And so all those variables that cannot be controlled really do influence the final outcome. And so I agree. It's very difficult to say with any certainty that it's the single-sex feature itself that's causing the ultimate outcome, the ultimate result. And there are those who are the critics of single-sex schooling who will raise this argument, and I understand it, because they'll say, well, you know, most of these schools just exhibit a number of features of effective schools, of good schooling. They have strong leadership, they have strong parent involvement, they have academically motivated students, and there is something to be said for that. But again, if you consider what the problems of these particular students are, particularly at-risk inner-city minority students, there is something to be said for separating them by gender for all the reasons that I've given. There is something that just makes sense in that regard. We're never going to know for sure, but you can say that about any academic program or any instructional reform, that we never know for sure whether it's the approach itself that's making the difference, because there are always these intervening variables that we cannot control for. We do have some studies from other English-speaking programs, large-scale studies from countries like Australia and the United Kingdom, which have more of a tradition with single-sex schooling, and they found significant academic gains for both boys and girls attending single-sex schools.
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. We have someone who's calling on a car phone, cell phone, so we'll get them first. Line number one. Hello.
David.
Yes.
Interesting subject. Having gone to an all-girls boarding school back in the dark ages, I'm very into secular schools for boys and girls, but more important to me would be that in this whole country that children, students wear uniforms. I think it would eliminate so many problems. I know it's not exactly what you're discussing, but I would like to know from our guests how she feels about uniforms in school.
Well, you could have students wearing uniforms in a co-ed setting and in a single-sex setting. So single-sex schooling is not essential to wearing
right.
uniforms. And I know they have been, I know in New York City there are some public schools that where uniforms are required of some sort. And I think maybe there are some exceptions if a particular family chooses not to. And there's something to be said, because it does take away that social pressure, particularly among teenagers, just dressing up for the other students in the school, and just it creates a context in which students can focus very, you know, much more specifically on academics. But you don't need single-sex schooling for uniforms.
Absolutely, and that is a point. I really feel like nationally, if everyone wore a uniform, we wouldn't have social problems like, trying to outdo each other. It would be a great savings for families. It just seems such a practical thing.
Mm.
But thank you much.
Oh, well, thank you for the call. Well, did Professor Solomon, in those schools that you have visited, those single-sex schools, do they have dress codes and dress policies, and do the kids wear uniforms?
Depends on the school. The Young Women's Leadership School in New York, there is a form of a uniform. The Young Women's Leadership School in Chicago, which is really modeled after the New York school, again, a middle school moving into a high school, there is a form of a uniform, some kind of dress code that the girls have to adhere to. Philadelphia High School for Girls, no. And Western High School in Baltimore, no.
Hmm. Let's go to another caller. This is Bloomington, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. You know, I was wondering how the how you'd respond to the argument that this just is a reenactment of the old arguments about segregation based on race.
Critics, I mean, there are critics and civil rights supporters who argue that separation on the basis of any criterion is impermissible, whether it's by race or by sex. To me, that's a very, in a legal sense, that's a very flawed analogy, and in a policy sense as well. When and the arguments, the legal arguments, hinge on Brown versus Board of Education, the 1954 Supreme Court decision that outruled racial segregation in public schooling. But there you had children who were forced to attend separate schools as a matter of law. And this was not a matter of choice for them. And those schools, as the court found, was really imposing a badge of inferiority on those children. In this case, in single-sex schooling, first of all, the programs are voluntary, so parents and students volunteer to attend these programs. And secondly, they really are empowering. They're not imposing a badge of inferiority by any stretch. If when you look at the girls attending the Young Women's Leadership School in New York City, they really do feel very empowered and very privileged by the fact that they're attending that school. And they feel that they have a certain stature in their community by the very fact that that they do attend the school. So the purpose of these programs is very different from racial segregation, and the effect is as well.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, then we've touched on this the legal question a couple of times. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, particularly for people who might not have been listening at the beginning of the program, because I think that for some people this would be a kind of bottom line issue, and they would say, well, doesn't the law say that any institution that receives federal funds cannot discriminate? And that means you can't discriminate on the basis of race, and you also can't discriminate on the basis of gender, which would seem to say that if you had a public school, that you couldn't do it, that you couldn't have a same-sex public school.
The legal arguments turn on two points. One of them is Title IX, which was a law enacted by Congress in 1972 that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in educational programs that receive federal monies, and public schools all receive federal monies of one sort or another. Now, the law itself, the other point that the legal arguments turn on is the Supreme Court's 1996 decision striking down the all-male admissions policy at the Virginia Military Institute. Looking at Title IX first, the law itself does not prohibit single-sex schools or classes amongst public elementary and secondary schooling. So the law itself is really silent on that. The prohibitions on sex separation only apply to institutions of vocational education, so a voc-ed school would not be permitted, or professional education or graduate higher education, and public institutions of undergraduate higher ed, public colleges, undergraduate colleges. And then there are certain exceptions in the law itself, but it's silent as to elementary and secondary schooling. In 1975, the old Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, which the new Department of Ed has come out of, HEW published regulations pursuant to Title IX. And there, the regulations talk about a prohibition with regard to single-sex classes within a co-ed setting. And the regulations also talk about comparability, that whenever a school district excludes one sex, it has to from schooling, it has to provide comparable courses, services, and facilities to the other group. But it doesn't say that the comparable services have to be provided in another single-sex setting. It doesn't say if you open a single-sex school for girls, you must have a single-sex school for boys. You could provide comparable services in a co-ed school. And that's the argument that's been made for the existing single-sex schools. And the regulations also talk about affirmative action, that a school district could take affirmative action to overcome certain conditions that might have limited the participation of one sex. And so single-sex schools argue that they're taking affirmative action to provide, particularly girls' schools, that girls have been limited in their participation in education in the past. Now, the Supreme Court's decision in VMI, the Virginia Military Institute case, there the court's decision leaves considerable room in the joints for well-designed programs that have clearly stated and non-biased objectives. As long as the program develops what the court says the talent and capacities of particular students, as long as it doesn't perpetuate sex stereotypes, as long as it's not providing a unique opportunity to one sex that's not available to the other in a substantially equal setting. So there's considerable room for interpretation within the court's decision in the VMI case that would permit single-sex schooling, public schooling, particularly for disadvantaged students. But those are the two legal points that keep arising in this debate.
We have about 10 minutes left in the program, and I think I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Rosemary Salamone. She's Kenneth Wong Professor of Law at St. John's University School of Law in New York City, and is one of the leading authorities on single-sex education. She's authored the book Same, Different, Equal, Rethinking Single-Sex Schooling. It's published by the Yale University Press, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think one of the kind of groups that has come forward in raising questions about single-sex education, particularly for girls, at least sometime not too long ago, would have been feminists, mm-hmm. who would have made the argument that they fought for a long time for equal opportunity to education for girls and for women, and that somehow going back to all-girls schools would be something of a step backwards. How do you think about that? How do you react to an argument like that?
Well, the interesting observation that I've made, that even among feminists, and I consider myself as a feminist as well, there seems to be a dividing line between those of us who attended a single-sex school, either in high school or in college, and those of us who didn't. And those of us who did seem to be far more supportive of these programs and understand the value of them than those who didn't. So the group of feminists, they're not monolithic on this issue. But we also have to understand that those of us who came of age in the 1960s and 70s did embrace a view of the sexes based on sameness and a view of equality based on assimilation, that we really believed that men and women were the same on a whole variety of criteria and that they should be entitled to the same privileges and benefits in society. And there was considerable merit to that argument that we should have particularly equal access to education and power and prestige equal to men. And so women fought very hard to gain entry into traditionally male academic institutions. And single-sex schooling, I understand that. It evokes very painful memories of exclusion from institutions like Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Central High School in Philadelphia and Stuyvesant High School in New York City and Bronx High School of Science and a host of boys' private schools as well, boarding schools. It really does evoke very painful memories of this. But we have to understand now that that we've learned a lot about child development and about education in the intervening years since the 1960s and 70s. And there is some suggestion in the research that boys and girls, for example, don't mature at the same rate, while men and women as adults are very similar in terms of their intellectual abilities, for sure. Boys and girls don't mature at the same rate. And so little boys come into school with not the same highly developed verbal skills as young girls do. But they do seem to have more advanced visual spatial skills, which makes them better in math, particularly to some degree in science as well. Ultimately, both groups catch up with each other. But it puts young boys in a really disadvantaged position in the early grades, where girls are just streaming ahead in reading and writing skills, and boys, and some young boys, just keep falling further behind. Ultimately, they do drop out. So we know that perhaps these maturational differences in and of themselves might justify separating girls and boys in the early grades. We also know there's research now indicating that girls, as Carol Gilligan said, lose their voice in middle school and in high school. We see girls that were very academically challenged in the earlier grades succumbing to the social pressure of adolescence and falling behind when they get to middle school and high school. And we should use this information and this knowledge that we have since the modern-day women's movement took hold in the 60s and 70s and think of single-sex schooling in a new light.
We have a couple of other callers here. We'll try to get them in the time that remains. Going next to someone in Chicago, which is line four. Hello.
Hello. I just wanted to give my own experience. I went to parochial schooling, which was co-ed up until high school and then single-sex. And what I remember happening was that the girl who was most academically accomplished was admired up until seventh grade. And then in seventh and eighth grade, it became the girl who was most socially accomplished. Also, at the same time, there was the pressure of a recruitment for seminary so that girls were almost ignored and emphasis was put on the boys who were potential priests. When I entered into a Catholic high school, all girls, immediately the whole emphasis was that they were creating this next generation of Catholic mothers, and Catholic mothers had to be politically active, socially concerned, and very intelligent if they were going to raise the next generation of Catholics. And when I look back on it, I wonder if this had been a co-ed school, would it have been possible to create this ideal of the model woman, whether you accept it or not, and try to inculcate in these young girls this idea, if it had been a co-ed school, because it was in every single aspect, not just in the classroom, but every single aspect of our lives was that we were being prepared for this noble endeavor. And at that time, I didn't think anything of it, and I probably sneered, but I think the fact that someone thought that I was about to engage in an ignoble endeavor for the rest of my life certainly affected my self-esteem. And I wonder if that is might be one of the benefits of being able to have a single-sex school.
Absolutely. Girls, in particular, are validated for whatever they do in a single-sex school. Whether it's academics or whether it's sports, there are a variety of ways in which girls can find self-realization and self-fulfillment in a single-sex environment. For many girls, you know, I don't believe single-sex schooling is for everybody, and I certainly don't argue that it's the panacea for all the ills that are troubling public education today. I think we'll always be predominantly a co-educational school system, and that's the way it should be. My argument is that it should be made available to students without the economic means to purchase it in the marketplace of private schools, because we do permit it within the private school sector, and that should be a decision that parents and their children make, because some students can benefit from it. And what you're saying is absolutely true, that girls do gain validation for their academic pursuits. And I think it's interesting, your fix on Catholic schooling at some time in the past of preparing women specifically for motherhood. I mean, that's not what single-sex schools are doing now. They're preparing women to have choices, to have options in their lives.
Yes. The one thing I do need to define, though, even though they were preparing them for motherhood, they always expected them to be an educated mother.
That's right. That's right. And, it's something that I, too, attended a Catholic high school, and it was a very academically rigorous high school. And I have to say, it was a defining moment for me. That was a defining experience in my life. And you hear other women who attended single-sex schools say the same thing. And also the fact that you saw women, whether in Catholic schools they were religious, members of a religious community, or they were lay teachers, you saw women who had an intellectual life. And that was very important as role models.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We're just about out of time. There is one question I want to ask, and I can only give you a minute or so to talk about it. I guess I'm just curious. When you look at the kinds of issues that we're talking about involving single-sex education and look across the different levels, that is elementary, secondary, higher, are the issues the same or does it change as the students get older?
My sense, and I have no hard data to support this, my sense is that perhaps elementary, in the early grades, single-sex schooling might benefit boys more because of those different maturational levels. And at the middle and high school grades, it may, you know, across the board, benefit girls in particular because of the social distractions. Although I think in the inner city, certainly boys have a lot to gain from single-sex schooling. And at the college level, I think the issues are somewhat the same and somewhat different, where you're not worrying about differences in maturational development, but it has more to do with validation and feelings of importance and self-fulfillment. And we should still have those options for women to attend single-sex colleges in particular, or for men as well, but just as an option.
Well, there we will have to leave it. My apologies. We have a couple of callers we can't take. If you're interested in reading on the subject, you can look for the book that we mentioned. It's titled Same, Different, Equal, Rethinking Single-Sex Schooling, published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Rosemary Solomon. She's the Kenneth Wong Professor of Law at St. John's University School of Law in New York. And Professor Solomon, thank you very much for talking.
Well,